is the New York State AFERD podcast entitled A through Z Health and PE. We are your co-hosts, Drs. C and C, the true Pan-American connection. I am Clancy Seymour, and my tag team partner is the one and only Dr. Victor Ramsey.
Details highlighting our episodes, guests, contact information, publications, and other useful resources will always be included in the podcast show notes. For more information about New York State AFERD, please visit newyorkstateaferd.org or Facebook and social media handles at New York State AFERD. Let's embrace the journey, and now, on to our show.
Greetings, listeners. I'm Dr. Clancy Seymour with my co-host, Dr. Victor Ramsey. Doc, how are you today?
I am doing very well down here in Brooklyn, New York, having a good old time with the weather. You know, I always talk about the weather. And I have to say, I've been having opportunities to go outside and take a walk and enjoy the weather. So I am doing well and always happy to be here with you.
Yes, indeed. We're just coming off of the holiday weekend in April, and April showers bring spring flowers. Mayflowers, right?
So hopefully, yes, absolutely.
We're on our way to a little bit more milder weather. Very exciting indeed.
Yes.
So welcome to the New York State AFERD A through Z Health and PE podcast. In this episode, we will be interviewing Dr. Stephen Harvey, who serves as professor and program coordinator of coaching, health, in physical education at Ohio University. This is truly exciting, Dr. Ramsey. We are honored and excited to have Dr. Harvey on the show. Steve is a world-renowned scholar and pedagogue, and his most recent book is co-edited with Dr. Richard Light, entitled Applied Positive Pedagogy in Sport Coaching, International Cases. Alongside this recent publication, Dr. Harvey has authored several journal articles focusing on games-based coaching to teaching physical education and coaching. You can learn more about Dr. Harvey's endeavors from the resources provided in today's episode, including his very own podcast. You can also connect with Dr. Harvey directly on Twitter at Dr. Stephen Harvey, all one word, to be able to connect with him on social media. Dr. Harvey, thank you for joining us today, my friend. And please say hi to our listeners and our panel, and of course, our illustrious members of New York State AFERD.
Hello, and thanks for having me, and welcome to the listeners. And we have a few students here from Dr. Seymour's class, so welcome to those. They're going to have to put up with me for the next 45 minutes or so, so we'll see how we go.
Well done. Yes, indeed, you are right. So as a professor at Ohio University, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? And because we always talk about our international roots, Dr. Ramsey and I, so I would be remiss if I didn't allow you the opportunity to share your past endeavors as well.
Indeed, I am originally from England, which is one country in the UK. I always ask people trick or treating whether they can tell me how many countries are in the UK, and that's how they get candy, but they always fail, so I'll give them it anyway. So I'm from England, the northeast part of England, which, yes, is not next to London. It's about 4.5 hours driving away along a very busy freeway motorway. So that's why I've got a little bit of a twang, because up in the north, we get towards Scotland. So people get me confused and they go, oh, you're Irish. And over here, I even get told I'm from New Zealand and Australia. So the world is... the world's a funny place. So I grew up there and then moved here twice to the United States, once in 2003 to do a PhD at Oregon State, go Beavs. And because at the time it was me and my girlfriend, now my wife, went back to the UK and specifically England, worked there for 7 years. And then I arrived back in the US working at West Virginia University, and then slid over here to Ohio because it was too mountainous in West Virginia. I'm just joking. So that's how I'm here. And I guess I've had various trials and tribulations along the way in terms of professing and moving up through the ranks of that. And then also teaching in local schools and coaching youth teams, masters international teams, college teams, and currently landed with a U11 girls soccer team who don't know much about the game, but they are learning quickly with my instructions. So that's it.
Fantastic. Well, we're very fortunate to have you join us. Indeed. Great stuff. So as Dr. Harvey mentioned, we have also invited a panel of undergraduate students from Canisius College who are taking my Principles and Philosophy of Coaching class. So very excited to have them join us on the podcast indeed. Each student has reviewed a recent journal article by Dr. Harvey alongside of the some of the other texts that Dr. Harvey has written. And the one article that they have reviewed for today's episode is written by Dr. Harvey and his colleagues. And it's entitled, written in 2022, it's entitled 50 Million Strong, The Contribution of Sports Coaching from the Research Quarterly for Exercise and Sport. So Dr. Harvey, before we get into our students and asking you some of the questions regarding the article, why don't you tell us a little bit about your co-authors and the genesis of this article itself, how it came to be?
Yeah. So Professor Hans van der Maas was the lead of the research consortium there in Shape America, the national organization. And he was commissioning various white papers, air quotes there, on various topics. So you've probably seen some on social justice, physical activity, pedagogy in a physical education setting. And he approached me and said, hey, is there any possibility that you could pull together a team of researchers here to work on a paper about, you know, where we're going to go with research over the next sort of 5 or 10 years, especially as we build up to the 50 million strong initiative, which I'm sure you've talked about on the pod before. And so I got in touch with people who I felt brought expertise to the table, and also to try and bring a diverse range of perspectives indeed to the paper. And Laurie was very gracious to say she would be involved. And Laurie sort of has always been involved in the creation of the NASB, the Shape America Coaching Standards, which were formerly the NASB Coaching Standards. Tim is a professor down in Florida State. So again, he's been doing research in physical education and sport coaching for a number of years, sport coaching ethics and this kind of idea. Lindsay is focused on more the sports psychology side of things, a little bit like Laurie. She brought the expertise with the confidence and sure. What was the other one? Confidence. Yes. If I didn't get those two right. And then Joy was the person who brought the expertise in terms of strength and conditioning and the physical development side. As we were looking at that, and he's now working at the IMG Academy. So I tried to put together people who, not just that I had already built some relationships with, but people who were all kind of heavily involved with Shape America, and were all bringing, like I said, diverse perspectives and specific expertise to the paper.
Awesome. You know, and just speaking or just hearing about how you developed that team of authors, Dr. Ramsey, it kind of speaks to how the coaching profession has evolved in terms of the expectations. It's no longer just being on the proverbial, using Dr. Harvey's air quotes again, the proverbial bench, thinking about winning the game. There's so much more.
Absolutely.
To coaching now than ever before to be successful.
Yes, yes, absolutely. This cadre of professionals in different areas, you know, with confidence and competence and the whole interpersonal piece and the psychology of it, it's just brilliantly put together.
A lot to think about. And, you know,
absolutely.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the expectations of coaches today. And in many cases, you know, a profession that still is at the youth level, at the grassroots, you know, so it's a lot to think about, a lot of responsibility a coach has to take on. So
absolutely.
Yeah. And so, the paper, as you just said, focuses on kind of the domain of youth sport particularly, and
sure.
We might have a couple of questions about levels and things like that. And there are levels in terms of even youth sport when we get into it, but this is particularly sort of the guardrails around that, where we're not talking in this paper about professional sport, but we are, there might be some outlets there for some individuals who are part of the sport coaching that goes on around the country that may raise to those professional college and at more elite levels. But we are very much focused on that holistic kind of idea of developing people first, and so that they can, you know, be good, healthy, contributing citizens.
Fantastic. So as we mentioned, we have a panel of undergraduate students from my coaching class that are here. And so I'm going to invite each of them to ask Dr. Harvey a question from the article itself. And we'll have them each introduce themselves briefly, and then they can ask Dr. Harvey the question. So we'll start with Mr. DaCosta. Danny, go ahead.
How are you guys doing today, Dr. Ramsey and Dr. Harvey? My name is Danny DaCosta. I'm a senior at Kinesis College. I have a major in sports, exercise, and healthcare, a minor in communication, and a minor in strength and conditioning. I aspire to be a coach to eventually have my own gym to, you know, I had experience with kids and helping them with basketball and education, and always giving, you know, kids the opportunity to, you know, keep going in life, find a positive way to get off the streets, stuff like that. I'm always been pushing, advocate. I'm an older brother, so I'm trying to lead the way. And I feel like being a coach would be a great way for me to show what I've been through to help, you know, lead, show my love for kids, and et cetera. Taking this class to help me graduate and to help learn the next level. And I'm on this podcast to learn from you guys after reading this article and to expand my understanding to become a future coach. Dr. Harvey, the article addresses many future ventures to consider your research and coaching. In a brief elevator pitch, would you like to add any ideas for our listeners?
This was the toughest question out of the lot. this is, you're like throwing this back at me as a student or a faculty member saying, can you keep this one short? Because we also do that to you as students and we push your buttons. But I'm going to share a few snippet passages from the paper, because I don't want to get off track. So I think the biggest thing is that there's approximately, as it says in the paper, 69% of all 6 to 12-year-olds participate at least one day a week in a youth sport program, with 37% participating in a team sport on a regular basis. Therefore, it's crucial that US coaches or US-based coaches are educated in a variety of areas to maximize positive experiences and the development of athletes, especially with respect to competence, confidence, connection, and character in these specific coaching contexts. So it's crucial to understand the current state of sport coaching research and propose future research needs for our discipline. And to do that, we want to look through the lens of a social ecological model, because that helps us understand the impact of the bi-directional interactions between the environment and individual behaviors like sport participation and coaching and coaches' behaviors. So that's more garbled. In other words, it's important we understand the frame of reference, like the statistics. We know some will even throw statistics out, like youth are dropping out and things like this of sport. Yet it can be a positive experience if it's coached right, by understanding more about what coaches do out in the field, by doing research on these different things. We can then develop teaching programs for the coaches in order to best develop coaches and give athletes positive experience related to those four athlete outcomes: connection, competence, confidence, and character.
Excellent. 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 Okay. So you kind of segued nicely into perhaps the next topic. And I believe Naz, one of my other students, will ask the next question. Go ahead, Naz.
How you doing, Dr. Ramsey and Dr. Harvey? My name is Nasir Benton. I'm a senior here at Kinesis. I attended here all 4 years. I major in sports management. I have the goal of either being a sports agent or a coach. But I really want to open up a community center for my community to give back to my community, and somehow for not just children of one age, but all ages, younger ages, so they can have education way if they need help, tutoring, gym, weight room, anything to keep them active and away from bad habits and bad things around the world. I do a lot of coaching and a lot of training with my uncle at the Magnica Center down on Clinton Street. It's 13 and under, but that's about it. I've been doing that since last summer. We've been trying to get the kids out since COVID happened, and it was like everything was getting pushed back. We just wanted to get back in the gym and stuff, so I'll be helping him with that. But my question is, Dr. Harvey, could you tell us the benefit of framing your investigation using a social ecological approach and how this can benefit current and future coaches?
Talk about another zinger there, Dr. Harvey. And, wow, Nas got you on your toes. That's pretty impressive.
Well, just going back to question one, I do want to say something about there is an importance now within the role of what we call coach developers. So we as faculty at universities could be considered coach developers because we're working with coaches, because we don't have degrees on becoming a coach educator. But obviously when students go out and they're coaching, and then if they like doing that, they will go do a master's degree, a PhD, and then look to become coach developers or work through a national governing organization. Like I do a bit of work for US soccer and become like a tutor for some of their classes. So that's an important piece to this paper, which we'll probably keep coming back to. With respect to the social ecological approach, and this fits in quite nicely, is we've got, like I said before, the interaction between different environmental factors in individual behaviors. So there are different levels of a social ecological model. So there's the individual, the interpersonal behaviors, and then we need to look at organizations, and then we also need to look at society as a broader society and what our expectations are within society. So one interesting one, because we mentioned it before, is how do coaching behaviors and what we perceive to be a good coach in life broadly. So like, let's take an example, Bill Belichick, he's at the professional level, or Nick Saban, I'm using football coaches here as an example. What do we think that they represent by doing various different things that they do? Do we think that coaches are good coaches when they're standing on the sideline, screaming at their players or grabbing players by the face mask? And what are our thoughts about that? But how does our frame of reference as a society affect how we understand the individual coaching behaviors of those coaches? And also, like, my values and beliefs may mean that I view those types of coaching behaviors as acceptable. And that might be because of the way in which they've been framed in the media, in newspapers, news articles, this type of thing. I might have friends who advocate for that type of coaching behavior and that kind of thing, and share a coffee with them and chat about the acceptableness of those types of behavior. So that gives you a bit of an example about how one thing like coaching behaviors, we could treat that on like the simple level of me and my values and how I behave myself, but those need to be considered in the broader frame of organizational policies, relationships with athletes at the interpersonal level, and about what is acceptable in society and that kind of thing. But that's just one example. So when you look at things through the social ecological model, it helps us attack some of these issues at the multiple levels in order that we can advocate for potentially best practices, and we can look at interventions, or we can ask, in this case, research questions at each of these levels. Because if we only understand coaching behaviors by ticking a sheet on a piece of paper, and we don't ask coaches why they behave in that way, or ask parents why they feel something is acceptable that a coach is doing, we're only getting half of the understanding of an issue, and we can't help coaches develop appropriate coaching behaviors for particular times and particular contexts if we only understand them at one level. Is that it, Vic?
Yes, this is awesome indeed. I like how you bring the sociological approach and connect that brilliantly to coaching. And I cannot wait for coaches to hear this episode, because I trust they are going to get a lot out of this. Well, I'm honored to introduce our next panelist. This is Mr. Alex, who you think you had zingers before. Wait till you hear this question. Alex, you on, man.
How's everyone doing today? I'm Alex. I'm a junior here at Canisius, and my major is sports journalism with a minor in coaching. And I'm looking to do an extra year, a fifth year in sports administration. And, you know, growing up, I always knew I wanted to do something with sports. And through sports, I always like to succeed. And just as much as I like to succeed, I like to see others succeed as well. So I feel like coaching was just meant for me. So I can help pass on the knowledge I get and help others to succeed. And going over these articles and these podcasts that you guys have made, they really helped me. So my question is, what is the important role physical education plays in physical literacy in Native? Has been well documented in literature. However, in your article, Dr. Harvey, you and your colleagues stress the importance of coaches and administrators adopting a holistic approach to physical literacy development. If you could please explain.
Yes, Alex, thanks. When we look at things from a holistic perspective, it usually means that we can look at it as the four frames we talked about in the social ecological model. So we don't just look at one level of the social ecological model, like the individual. We need to consider the individual as part of the interpersonal relationship between them and the coach, what organization they're working for, and a broader frame of, well, what's the purpose of sport in society? So that's one way in which we need to understand. The second way that we need to understand holism from the perspective is looking at, I think in physical education, if some of you involved in physical education, and Dr. Seymour might have said this in his class, you might look at things from a psychomotor or a physical standpoint. You might look at things from a cognitive standpoint and an affective standpoint, which is a little bit more about the social, biopsychosocial, you know, social emotional kind of lens. So when we look at physical literacy development, we need to try and some of the misunderstandings of physical literacy in the past has been an overemphasis on the focus of competence. So we look at four athlete outcomes in relation to physical literacy development, so to speak, in the paper. So one is competence, one is connection, another one is the other is confidence, and then the other one is character. So by trying to develop individuals with these four outcomes in mind, and through those three different domains, psychomotor/physical, cognitive, and affective, we're really trying to look at a perspective of developing a whole person rather than just somebody in the physical sense of the being, or in a psychomotor sense. The problem, like I say, with physical literacy sometimes is the way it's been treated in the literature, and also is that it gets reduced to those psychomotor behaviors because we're dealing in a very physical domain where we're building motor skills and we're interested in motor development and motor learning. Of those skills, we sometimes overemphasize that over other areas. So what is the person thinking? What is the person feeling whilst attempting a particular motor skill? So then it becomes interesting about how we give feedback, the type of feedback, for example, and how we position them with relation to someone's stage of learning and or development, and about what their maybe aspirations and intentions are for why they're out there playing sport. So my daughter plays soccer. She's out there for the affective development. She probably wants to develop her confidence as a person over other areas, and it's my job to support her doing that. Is it beneficial to her to develop competence? Yes, because that does give her more confidence that she can do things. She scored her first goal in a soccer competitive match at the weekend. And when she scored, the whole sideline erupted and all her teammates were diving on top of her to celebrate. This is a moment that is key, and it really gives a good example about physical literacy. She went to this thing called striker training in the winter. She worked on striking the ball at the goal. And had she not have been to those sessions, she probably wouldn't have scored this goal at the weekend. That said, her main intention of being out there is for kind of psychosocial reasons, because she's got friends on the team who she goes to school with and things like that. So it's important from a physical literacy standpoint that we teach and reward those different behaviors. And then if I link to the notion of character, she can get frustrated like all of us with learning. So it's a matter of coaches being there to be supportive of young people in dealing with adversity. I had a girl crying at my soccer practice the other day because I was stretching them maybe a little bit too, and particularly her, to do something that she wasn't yet comfortable in doing. But I tried to explain to the team that that was a teachable moment for us all, that sometimes we're going to get into struggle and we need support from each other and our teammates in order to be successful. And she played the game at the weekend and did wonderfully well. And therefore, high fives, etc. Easter eggs were plenty at the weekend. So, you know, the idea of physical literacy is trying to look at things from, like I say, that holistic standpoint, where it's not just trying to develop people in the sense of the physical, but also looking where we can build connection between teams, individuals, the coach and the players with their own parents and other parents, me as the coach with the parents, and also organizations like community centers, where you would want, like Naz said, work in a community center where the purpose is to really build that sense of community, where it's a safe space that people can go, especially when people might not feel there's a safe space in the family home at times. So I think that this is the richness in all the examples I've used here. I think people can see why physical literacy has to be holistic, because if we just focus on the competence development and don't do the high fives and all the cheering and, you know, and have social events and rewards and this type of thing and talk about teachable moments, we're kind of missing a trick.
Yes, yes. As I was reading, and again, your four C's, and you made that, talk about that connection, but the one word that stood out greatly to me was the word character. And I thought about great coaches that exemplify that. And when you talked about that, I thought about the great Pat Summit, John Wooden, and as of late, Dawn Staley. So, yes, of course. Thank you.
Well, and if Alex is going to be a sport admin person, I mean, he'll understand that when you go into organizations, that building character and having the right people on the bus is really important, and how you build an organization. Sometimes, like even a community center, from the boots on the ground, or how that organization represents the people within it. But also we have to have the competence development, because we're here connected, because it's about developing skills, physical skills, to be able to move forward and progress. So all those things intertwine, and that's why people have kind of thought that physical literacy is of central importance to us developing young people.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, Dr. Harvey, this is one of the key concepts of the article that really resonates with me, because as you and I share similarities, we are teacher educators, we are coach educators, and right now physical literacy is a very strong initiative in PE programs and physical education programs, health education literacy, health literacy as well. But recognizing that physical education is not physical literacy, that it contributes to the societal goal of physical literacy, but recognizing that it's not just on physical educators, that coaches are very critical to help foster and nurture each child's individual journey to physical literacy. These are things I talk about during trainings with school districts, and how important a coach is in this equation, because it should not just be the health educator. It should not just be the physical educator. It has to be the coach educator. And I think you really address that well with that holistic, organic approach.
Well, absolutely.
And to your point, you know, the 50 million strong goals are very good ones, because they address improving physical literacy, increasing physical activity levels, and encouraging lifelong physical activity. And as we know, the development of physical literacy is, some people argue, there's not an end point. It's always developing, and it's always changing. Like me, I go running now, And yes, playing soccer and field hockey is, and doing badminton, I was always kind of moving, but was running, as I'll do in 2 weeks' time, at half 13.1 miles. Is that something that I was always able to do? No, but it's part of my journey. And I've had to learn new skills and get different physical competencies, but I've also needed encouragement of other people along the way to get where I'm going. And I've had to go to some running clubs and buy some different equipment, read about different things to get a cognitive understanding of what I'm going to do. And I think in the paper, we also talk about competence also being that kind of cognitive game understanding. If you play in a, like we talked about soccer, part of developing that cognitive piece is being able to understand the game, reflect on the game, watch video of the game, unpack the game from that standpoint. So understanding not just skills, but also concepts, but also knowing about that games are there to develop my own confidence and character as well.
Indeed.
That is awesome.
And the other thing that I've been grappling with over the last several years, and I've and now I kind of communicate to other coaches, is the idea of exercise as punishment. In PE, we've gone away from that train a long time ago. We don't use exercise as punishment, but in coaching circles, we still do sometimes. And myself included, I coach much like you, Dr. Harvey. We have similar interests. I've coached sports like rugby. You do field hockey. I do ice hockey, but nevertheless, sports like, again, ice hockey, football, whatever it may be. And there were times in my earlier years that something's not going right. I feel like I don't have the athlete's attention. And all of a sudden I'm lining them up on the goal line and I'm having to do wind sprints or stops and starts on the ice, things like that. Not recognizing that I'm negatively reinforcing exercise. Now, for the coaches listening, don't mistake my words for me saying I'm not interested in fitness. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that coaches have to recognize the bigger picture, that if you start negatively associating exercise with all of your athletes, 99.9% of them are not going to pursue professional careers. We want them to live an active lifestyle as adults. So we have to find different ways to embed fitness and different ways to get their attention. And that's just one example. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Harvey?
Well, I think you've encapsulated it a lot. I mean, if we're doing physical development exercises, those, like anything else we should be doing, should be planned as part of a programmatic curriculum and potentially don't need to be used as a way of reinforcing things that we don't want to see in our program. You know, if we are going to do physical development of the athletes, we need to do it in an appropriate and safe manner. And we as coaches, yeah, need to push people beyond their capabilities, but at the same time, we can regulate that because of the way we set up our sessions. So throwing in extra this, extra that, particularly with a physical standpoint and not looking at, and this is probably more than a grassroots coach needs, this term periodization. So kind of flouting the way we periodize our training, and we're doing sprints at the end of practice when maybe they're better off at the start. We need to have a little bit of a better understanding about how we periodize our practices over the course of a week, and also do that within sessions so that we don't physically and socially and emotionally burn out the young people and sort of turn them off from wanting to come to our sessions. It's always easy to be to be evangelical about all these things, because
sure.
Here on a podcast, it's very easy.
Yes.
But when you're frustrated with 10-year-olds, some things might look a little bit different.
Yep.
But you know, we have to, you know, we're going to talk about reflection next, so we can reflect on these things and try and do better as
indeed.
We move
forward. Residual coaching versus
indeed
indeed.
Well, and you're a living testimony of the lifelong pursuit of physical activity by saying you began with your running, and myself, I started boulding, and I'm gonna see how that goes, but that's something again to self-motivation. Well, we have another illustrious student here with us, Miss Eliza Hansen, who is one of our amazing panelists here. Eliza.
Hi everyone, I'm a sophomore here and I am a double major in sports and exercise healthcare and health and wellness with a double minor in coaching and strength and conditioning. I currently am a coach at CrossFit, and this summer I'm coaching at a place called Garage Strength down in Pennsylvania, working with different athletes there. Coaches have had such a strong impact on my life and influenced where I am now, and I just want to be able to have a fraction of the influence coaches have had on me on somebody else. So, Dr. Harvey, my question to you is, why do you think it is important to investigate more about how coaches learn and the reflective practices they engage in? And do you think this approach applies to coaching at any level?
Good question. Lots to unpack here. I think to get the easy part out of the way, the end bit of the question, do you think this approach applies to coaching at any level? Yes, because it's like whenever we learn something, there's this constant pattern of spiraling. So the better we get, maybe the more there is to reflect about, or the process we use to reflect needs to change and be a little bit more nuanced because of either the athletes that we're working with, or because of the changes that we've made to our own, professional learning and development over time. If you work coaching one athlete, it might be very different than if you're in a group setting, for example, in a gym and strength and conditioning situation, and you might need to use and think about different feedback strategies and techniques and things like that in the act of coaching, and your reflective practices might be, the process might be the same, but you may need to consider different things depending on who it is you're working with and things like that. So that's kind of the second part of the question. Why do you think it's important to investigate more about how coaches learn and the reflective practices they engage in? I think when we talk about how coaches learn, we talk about it from a mediated standpoint and an unmediated standpoint. And then we also talk about it as an internal standpoint. So some of the learning we do internally is about what we learn about I work for US Soccer, so we say learning about oneself. So can we learn more about oneself? If you get kind of wound up by a young child and you are coaching, you might react in a certain way to some things they said to you, and you might not think on reflection that that was best practice. So you would want to learn a little bit more about yourself and your own, the way you behave. And what you could do there is video yourself coaching and at least just watch that back. If you know that you might have some physical metrics about, how much engagement time there is in your coaching session, you might need to, again, unpack those. And if people are standing around a lot, because we know that people stand around a lot in coaching sessions, even though they're not supposed to, they do that in physical education, where we know that half the lesson and more than half the lesson is inactive or very low physical activity. We might need to reflect and think about different strategies about how we promote movement within our classroom or in our coaching session. And one way of doing that, as you're learning about, is to use a more of a game-based approach, where particularly in an invasion game, players, because they're playing games and small-sided versions of games, they're less complex, they're getting more touches on the ball and this kind of thing, if we talk about soccer, and therefore their physical engagement is higher. And I would even say their cognitive engagement and social emotional engagement is higher. But we do need to do drills and other activities sometimes to, so all this around what we're doing is this internal kind of process where we're trying to think about what we do ourselves and make ourselves kind of get better without any external influences. The other thing that we have is these mediated learning situations, like you, when you go to class with Dr. Seymour, he's given you all these articles to read, and in the hopes that you will actually read them and you will take information from them, not just by highlighting, but also writing copious notes and thinking about how they apply to your practice. You will go to class, discuss different things about these articles with your colleagues, like we're doing here on the podcast. And therefore, it's a mediated learning situation, because you're hoping the expertise of Dr. Clancy Seymour will help you go to another level, right? And then there are other situations that are kind of unmediated situations where these are more, they might give you like a certificate, but they're not a license to coach, or, and those are things like attending professional development workshops or doing things kind of as part of your job, but you kind of don't. So Dr. Seymour was saying about going to the SHAPE conference next weekend. So he's going to go there and sit in the pub the whole time. I'm just joking. I'm using that as a way of saying that it's unmediated, because no one's there telling him that he has to go to 15 different sessions from 6 different professors. You know, he can go there and go to the sessions he wants, but he will get be able to produce a certificate and say that he showed up there and went to a certain amount of sessions. So he can kind of take from that what he wants, you know. And so depending on the type of situation you have, mediated, unmediated, or internal, that gives you a little bit more volition about the ways in which you learn as a coach. And we know that coaches get a lot more out of unmediated and internal situations than they do formal mediated situations. So another unmediated situation, Eliza, might be that you come and watch me coach, I come and watch you coach, and we give each other some feedback. So that would be a way in which we could have unmediated learning, but kind of also take advantage of that internal learning process. So all these things are vital for how coaches learn. And then that goes into how we reflect, because if we engage in a little bit of each of those things, then hopefully that will allow us to build some tools to be able to reflect on what it is that we're doing and build some kind of frameworks about where we can do some of that cognitive housekeeping that we need to do, that metacognition about thinking. So, oh, this situation happened. How could I do that differently? There was a situation the other week where I had to try and calm a kind of a group of parents down, and I was a bit vociferous with the way that I asked them to calm down. If I had that time again, I would surefire way, maybe do that, use some slightly different words, you know, because it would have took a little bit more heat, I think, out of the situation. And maybe I even added a little bit of fuel to the fire, which was not my intention, but maybe from other people viewing that situation, because this, I had a copy of this on video and I was like, So I think, you know, we have to have a reflective process. We have to maybe sometimes go beyond just thinking about what we do differently in the car. We need to think about setting some goals for ourselves. And sometimes those could be different types of goals, but they give us some things to hang our hat on. And I think we need to be going and thinking about our internal learning all the time, the cognitive housekeeping, going to workshops, seminars, going to observe other coaches to help us think about a better way of doing something, and also to go into those mediated situations. The last thing I will say is I was on Twitter yesterday, and don't worry, I'm not going to get political here. But I saw even just something simple, like where a coach was had put some sticks out, or like a mannequin out, to kind of say that's that a sideline player who's like a bumper player in soccer, basically you couldn't hide behind the mannequin, so you had to move either side of the mannequin. So that gets players moving and the coach isn't having to do anything. So for me, even I have blind spots, and even for me, that was something that I was like, oh, I could do that with some coaching sticks that I have. So I'm going to try that out next time I go out and do that. So that's an example of, you know, how learning and reflection can play out, going to Twitter, seeing a couple of things, thinking about the coaching context that I have and how best I can, you know, but we need to understand more about what different coaches' processes are, how coaches are learning, what range of learning experiences they're having, and that kind of thing, and do that across different levels to get a way better understanding of, you know, how a coach is learning and reflecting, in order that we can continue to get the provision of coaching education right for coaches here in the United States.
Wow. Truly impressive. Indeed. Very thoughtful and deliberate approach to Eliza's questions, Dr. Ramsey. What do you think?
Yes. I'm beyond speechless here because
I love the fact that, you know, a gentleman with Dr. Harvey's acumen starts off with recognizing that as a coach, it doesn't matter if you're Bill Belichick, he mentioned, or Pat Summitt. You need to be humble. You need understand that you can always get better.
Which and there's room for improvement with everything and every time.
Journey,
that's right.
We've said that how many times? Excellence is a journey, recognizing that. And then, you know, I loved how, you know, Dr. Harvey referenced, again, from Eliza's question, the idea of mediated versus unmediated.
Mediated. Yes.
Intrinsic versus extrinsic. Impressive, really impressive indeed.
Yes, and you taking time out of your own personal life to grow professionally by attending various conferences, workshops, and getting a bit from everything. So that is definitely something that we should be taking note of. Looking at other coaches, their practice, their style,
and picking up
tidbits from here, creating your own. I love that. Agreed. I love that.
And there's not.
And by the way, by the way, this all can also be applied to even teaching. As absolutely. You see, you know, some of those strategies. I already was thinking about that.
Yeah,
as you were talking.
Style. Yeah, absolutely.
Man, you nailed this. Yes, for sure.
100%. So, yep. Our last guest panelist today has been patient. And I'm looking forward to him grilling Dr. Harvey as well. We have Gavin Coughlin. Go ahead, Gavin.
Hi, Dr. Harvey, Dr. Ramsey. My name is Gavin Coughlin. I'm a senior here at Canisius, majoring in sport pedagogy and coaching. My coaching experience is confined to basically like youth soccer and lacrosse. And my interests are also within youth sports. I think that as a young person, you learn a lot more than just the sport when you're competing or practicing at a, you know, at any level really. But as a coach, you should also be, you know, emphasizing more than just sports skills. It's life skills that you're really coaching. So that's why I have interest in coaching. But my question for you, Dr. Harvey, is wellness, life balance, and burnout are proposed for future research, but these issues may conflict with the continued competitiveness of the profession itself. Please share your thoughts.
Yeah, this is a good question as well, because you're trying to polarize things and, you know, these always lead to sort of good discussions, and there's a bit of ethics in here as well. But really, the first point to make within the context of this paper, the research, a bit like the reflection kind of processes and things like that, we don't understand a lot about them, and especially at the different levels of what the individuals do. How do we work with other people with reflection? How do organizations have reflective practices within some of the coaching education they do? And the same, you know, from a broader society, how well do we respect the reflective processes and give people time to be able to do this? The same goes for sort of health and wellness. We tend to, as a society, reward this kind of like go get them kind of behaviors where everyone's switched on 24/7. We work 80 hours a week. Some of you said you're doing strength and conditioning things. So we love to be up at 5 a.m. taking Twitter videos, you know, and showing everyone about how we're pushing 435 pounds for a squat or whatever. But these are sometimes the type, you know, every days and all this kind of thing. So there is a little bit of a narrative about we need to be displaying these types of behaviors and have this kind of always on type of idea. There was a coach that I saw something posted the other day is I tell my players that I have a wife, I'm a wife and I have a family, and I leave the office at 5:30 and I'm the coach, and I'll get to your message the next day. You know, I'm not going to be checking my email at 10 p.m. just to check that everything is, you know, okay and answer your questions. And yes, there might be a life event within that for one of your players and you want to be there for them. And there will be some things that work out of these boundaries, right? That where you say, hey, he's my number in case there is an emergency, but this is what an emergency is. But this idea of us always being on and always being available and, you know, and people expecting us, like coaching, as you know, if you work in youth sports, you're pretty much working all the evening, all weekends. So I'm coaching next weekend, all weekend. I've got a game with my son Friday night, and I'm basically coaching every other evening this weekend, bar Wednesday, where again, I'll have to take my son to his sport event. And then during the day, I'm doing my professorial job, which guess what is related to coaching and teaching. So it's the same for teachers. We need to make sure that we're taking time throughout the day to take a step back. We're getting up out of our chair. We're moving around. We are chatting to people and being around people that we enjoy being around, that, as you mentioned before, we're staying humble. We're asking for feedback. We're looking at our dietary behaviors. We're not necessarily over consuming, caffeine or, other things that might be bad for our health and things like that. We're getting regular health checkups. We're looking at, are we getting regular vacations, all this kind of thing. So all this are things that are very important for us as teachers and coaches, so that we're not on 24/7 and available, because we need to take time out for ourselves so that we're energized to help the people that we are working with. And as you probably know, all of you, the students here on this call, if you've been out and done any type of coaching, or you've been out and teaching practicum or anything like that, it being around a group of young people for a long period of time during the day, it's exhausting. And giving your time to others and sacrificing is exhausting too. So if you don't take breaks out of what it is that you're doing, you're going to go down into that kind of spiral where you're going to be feeling the effects of it. So that's why kind of mental health and well-being is important. We see a lot of people quitting coaching. So the strength and conditioning is a good example. I've seen things about, I've had to quit because I'm away with the team multiple weekends. I'm up at this time and I'm still in the weight room at that time, and I'm not getting the break that I have, or everything that no one else wants to do gets dumped on me because I'm the strength and conditioning coach. Sometimes the pay and compensation we get can be quite poor in some of our profession, but obviously some of the benefits we get from it can be quite good, right? Being around high-performing athletes or youth elite level athletes, or just being around a group of kids who are, pretty grounded and keep make you feel young about yourself and things like that. So I think we need to do things to think about and protect ourselves. We also need to think about, like it's written in the paper, policies around, the recruitment of different coaches, to give opportunities for coaches of all diverse backgrounds and that kind of thing. So we talk a little bit about that in the paper too, and about some of the challenges that are faced by, people. Maybe you're coming from, like you're all there doing a degree and maybe is doing a degree out there and available for everybody who wants to do one, from a financial standpoint. So we've got to make sure that if we're going to put coaching out there as a profession where we want people to have an undergraduate degree, we need to support them going through those processes so they can, like Naz, get out into the community, run those community centres, do a good job, and, understand how to best serve the local community, but have the qualifications and experiences to do so. So that, I probably haven't unpacked that perfectly necessarily, but those are the types of things that we're talking about. And there's just a complete dearth of literature on, what are some of the challenges faced by grassroots coaches, particularly youth sport coaches, and, how do we best support them in being everything to everyone, especially when they're doing everything else on top.
Wow. I tell you, this has been amazing time spent today. So brings us to our closing. So on behalf of New York State AFER, we would like to thank Dr. Harvey and our Canisius College undergraduate panelists for joining us today to share thoughts and perspectives. And to our listeners, especially coaches and our future professionals, the information shared today could serve as a catalyst for your ongoing preparation as coaches and as future professionals in our disciplines. This session will be posted on the New York State AFERD website and on our podcast channel. Stay tuned for new and exciting episodes scheduled later in the year.
Thanks, Dr. Harvey. Please visit us at newyorkstateaford.org. Social media handles at New York State Aford, or call us at 315-823-1015 for more information. Please also take note of our professional development events throughout the year, including our annual state conference at the Turning Stone Casino in Verona, New York, each year in November. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.